This is Amber Ray
and Rusty Tanton,
and you're listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network, the show focused on all things Atlanta and sometimes elsewhere.
It's August 10th. We're in Augusta, Georgia, in front of the New Moon Cafe with Peter Hughes, who has a great interest in Henry Schultz. Could you tell us a little bit about Henry Schultz?
Well, Henry Schultz was one of these immigrants that shows up in early American history and lives the American dream. He has wild visions and ideas and goals and goes out there and fights the good battle and at least temporarily makes it good, drives in a carriage with four white horses and throws a big party anytime he feels like it, has his own little palace on top of the hill with cannons that he fires off anytime the occasion strikes him. So he had a great time, but along with that came a lot of intellectual baggage, you might say. He was, he had a tendency to go for the gold and overreach himself, and back in those days, financial panics came along every now and then, and he fell for every single one, hook, line, and sinker. And then afterwards, grumbled and complained incessantly about how he'd been handed his head by a bunch of crooked bankers.
That was one of the things that struck me about him as I was reading on your website and a couple of other places. His language was so florid, and he everything was a mortal wrong toward him.
Well,
it wasn't just
was megalomania.
Yeah,
I think megalomania is an excellent term. In fact, there's a passage here that he used when he was talking about his bridge. And after a whole bunch of stories of his woes, he concludes, "Fate has decided in my favor, and you shall find in me a Carolus the Great, the founder and defender of ancient Hamburg, and Bonaparte, the conqueror of the Bridge of Lodi. Hamburg will rise, and Augusta will never regain the lost trade of South Carolina as long as the waters of the Savannah divide the two states." So that's exactly the term that came to my mind when I read that.
Yeah, I think actually that was the quote that stuck out the most to me. I read that.
But actually, that's an interesting quote because he mentions the founder of Hamburg, which of course was a town that he grew up in. Yes. In Hamburg, Germany. It's a great inland port and just ruled the globe with its commerce. And they made just heaps of money having ships come in, unload everything, and then reload it to shipment all throughout Europe. And I think that the image in his mind was a New World version of Hamburg, and he saw himself as that founder. He was going to be the man with his name on the big plaque saying, "Henry Schultz created this incredibly successful commercial town in the New World."
So just to back up for a second, because, I mean, obviously you're familiar with it. We've done some reading on him. Could you just give the 30-second overview of Henry Schultz and his background? Came to Augusta in 1806, and then what happened?
Henry Schultz came in 1806 and got a job on the river, mm-hmm. pulling boats down to Savannah and back up to Augusta. With the cargo, cotton going one way, cigar, iron, paper coming the other. And evidently he worked his little fanny off, because next thing you find in 1813, he has this wild idea to build a bridge across the river. And he had a lot of opposition to overcome, because after all, he was just a deckhand on a boat that had worked his way up a little bit. But that was a time of opportunity, and Augusta needed a bridge, and he got tens of thousands of dollars of backing, and he went out and did it.
That really is amazing, because weren't there two attempts to build a bridge before that, and both of them were taken into the river?
Exactly, and it was done by the richest man in America, Wade Hampton I, who was made a ton of money speculating in the Yazoo Project in far western Georgia, and he thought everybody needed bridges. He built three in Columbia by his estate there, and all three washed away. And he built two in Augusta, and both of those washed away. And here comes Schultz and says, well, I think I can do it. And he found a mechanic, as they called him back in those days, by the name of Lewis Cooper. And they did a bang-up job. And that bridge stood for the next 75 years.
That is amazing. It's also amazing, too, is, I mean, architecturally, it was kind of some old design principles in the bridge, wasn't it, as well?
Exactly. It was archaic. It was what's called a king post truss, yeah. Which is basically the same thing used since medieval days to build, you know, roofs for buildings.
Yeah.
And they did a repeat-as-required routine and marched these little rooftops all the way across the river until, boom, it all connected into a bridge.
So, yeah. So you basically got this day laborer who came with this archaic design and managed to get funding for the thing.
Exactly.
And so that's a pretty amazing story. How did you, what first attracted you to that story?
Well, I'm an engineer, and I read about this guy and his bridge and how he would order people off the bridge if they were too slow or he didn't like them or he didn't like the way their horses dumped all over his bridge on the last time. Ah, beautiful downtown Augusta.
Yeah.
And I had in my mind that it was a rickety little affair, maybe with some boats anchored in the water and some planks laid across them. And when I actually found out, I had no idea that it was a bang-up job built to endure through the ages.
How did you find out? Because one of the things you talk about on your website is that there were no hits in Google for this. There's no, I mean, what was your original source? How did you come across it to begin with?
Well, that's a good question because before I started on this, I'd never done any real historical research at all. I mean, true research beyond just opening a book and reading what some other guy found out.
Yeah.
And I would read newspaper articles, and every 10 years, all the newspapers around here will come up with the amazing story of Henry Schultz and Hamburg. And they all recycle pretty much the same stuff. I could pretty much tick off the list of facts that they were marching through, just repeated from hand to mouth. And I thought, you know, I won't be satisfied until I find out one new thing that nobody ever really knew before. And actually, I found out that was a pretty tough job because the stories were out there, and as a matter of fact, the stories were all true. That's what I was actually proving, was when you go to the archival records, sure enough, there it all is. Every crazy thing that you ever heard about the guy is an honest-to-God recorded, documented fact. So maybe that's the most interesting thing that I discovered.
Yeah. I think what struck me about it immediately is just that he's sort of a bundle of contradictions. On one hand, he's at times at least, a pretty brilliant entrepreneur, even though he ends up losing his money later. But on the other, he's kind of a lunatic. I mean, you know, the guy, didn't he pistol whip somebody at some point?
It wasn't a pistol whipping, but it was close enough.
Yeah.
He did have a vicious anger, and I found a story as early as 2 years after he showed up in Augusta where he just ran into a house and completely clocked a guy and then hid out for the rest of the night while the guy tried to hunt him down with a pair of pistols. So he was a lusty fellow and lived a full and rich life, but he was a victim of his emotions.
Yeah.
And, for example, the whole Hamburg project was, they say it was built out of spite, and that is truly the case. He built Hamburg, a whole town on the other side of the river, just to give Augusta the shaft. That was the sole reason for it. And from a business standpoint, Hamburg didn't make much sense, to tell you the truth, because Horace Greeley said, go west, young man, and that's where the opportunity was. If you wanted to found a city and make a ton of money, you needed to go west where there was expansion and new opportunities. But South Carolina was built out. They got a little better and faster growing cotton there, but essentially it was built out. Never was going to get any better than it was, so he was working to just split a little bit of the market off for himself. And that's just not where your real future is.
Yeah. When you read the historical accounts, they will describe Hamburg as briefly being a modest success. That's at least some of the things I read. Would you say that's accurate?
I'd say that's indeed accurate. You know, Augusta truly was the gateway to the West back in those days, because there were no large cities as you kept going on from Augusta. And Augusta also was the first chance you had to wrap under the mountains and get up into Tennessee.
Yeah.
So it truly was a gateway and had a lot of goodies coming in its direction. So a cut of that is not such a bad idea. And so Schultz, I'm sure, saw all these wagons carrying produce across his bridge that had been stolen from him into Augusta. And he said, well, what would happen if I just intercepted that produce on the South Carolina side of the river and not only give Augusta the shaft, but stick it to the guys that stole my bridge? So he kind of got a twofer with that one.
So the bridge came first, and then the town of Hamburg came later. Right,
because that was his first financial panic, was the panic of 1819. So he built the bridge in 1813 and then just ruled the roost. Man, he was the man.
They were printing their own money, weren't they?
They were literally printing money off of the success of the bridge.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so he lived a life of ease and prosperity, and then it all came crashing down because he just pushed it a little too far. And when the price of cotton dropped by half in 1819, everything just collapsed.
I mean, there was a period of time, I read, where that money that they were printing was viewed as more reliable, more trustworthy, maybe, than even the U.S. currency going through there. And then it all of a sudden, later, with the panic,
it was worthless.
Yeah, and then it was just worthless.
Well, I think as Schultz might have argued is that back in those days, you would print money based on the value of some gold.
Yeah.
But people couldn't see gold. Gold didn't draw any interest, you know, and after all, what is it really good for? But here he had this bridge that was, you know, built for the ages. It's built out of Cyprus, which is almost as long-lived as gold is. It was never going to rot. The bridge would always be there. You could see the traffic crossing, tossing change into the toll booth every time they went by. And it was a very solid asset, so why not?
Yeah.
Go for it. But the problem is that some guy mortgaged that bridge for, you know, I don't know if it's ulterior motives or what, but he mortgaged the bridge in order to save his own butt. And sure enough, he got caught up in the panic too, lost the bridge, and then all of a sudden, it's like your stash is gone.
Yeah.
And so the money had nothing to hold it up anymore.
What happened with that mortgage? It was another guy, right? John McKinney, was that his name?
John McKinney was his name, and it's still not clear to me if he was a real bad guy or not, but Schultz certainly didn't like him anymore after the bridge debacle. But John McKinney is the guy that signed a mortgage for the bridge for, I think, $90,000. And sure enough, he wasn't able to pay, and Bank of the State of Georgia held his feet to the fire and said, by God, you didn't make your payment on time. Everything belongs to us. And they were more than happy to get their hands on that cash cow and defend it by any means, fair or foul.
Now, was this mortgage, this bum mortgage, was this the first real example of Schultz's animosity toward Augusta? Is this what turned him, or was there anything before that?
No, that was it. Up to then, he was happy as a clam.
Yeah.
He had built literally the most distinctive and useful things that Augusta had, and they all bowed to him and said, you know,
and
you're
in some
just
of the accounts,
a great guy.
He's not afraid to say so either.
But I have a feeling that he did tick some people off because, you know, for example, the story about how he run people off of the bridge because he just didn't like them. And there must have been some other capricious and arbitrary behavior in there, because when he started to go down, people kind of jumped on him.
Yeah.
And the city of Augusta was actually involved in the transaction where his bridge was taken away from.
Well, there was someone who was a future mayor of Augusta who physically ripped him out of one of the toll booths that he was refusing to leave.
That was a horrific story. You know, Schultz was one of those guys that believed possession is 9/10 of the law. So after a court said this bridge is no longer yours, his response was, the hell you say, I'm still in this toll booth collecting tolls. And the prosecuting attorney and the president of the local branch of the bank went down to the toll booth and ripped them out by the fingertips. And
these are upstanding society type people too. This isn't.
Well, the attorney went on to become a congressman, a U.S. congressman, and mayor of Georgia. And the other fellow went on to become a longtime, highly respected mayor of Augusta, Georgia. So Schultz's response was, "Well, I'll go to the toll booth on the other side of the river and hang out in that one, and you come dig me out of this one." And he continued trying to charge tolls as people crossed the bridge from that end.
And then there are cases of people camping out on the pine deck of the bridge, building fires because they didn't want to pay on the other side.
I think that story dates from a little later when basically the same thing happened. The folks were charged the toll as they came on the bridge. They were recharged the toll as they left. They said, well, heck, we're not paying twice. So they camped out in the middle. But what Schultz did, this was in 1827 by now, he would, when he collected the money for that week, he would come to the center of the bridge and hold an auction. And he would say, okay, for this money that I collected for my toll booth, I'm going to hold an auction to offer to buy back as many of my old bridge bills as possible, because he wanted to make good all that old money that had went bad back when the bridge was first taken away. And he kept chipping away at it any way that he could. And this was one of his ways. And so he'd hold an auction. He might have $20 in tolls. And somebody would say, I'll give you $90 worth of bridge bills for that $20. And he'd say, okay. And then they'd hold a ceremony. And then they'd burn the bills in the middle of the bridge. I don't know if they used a magnifying glass like they did in the case of the Yazoo Law. But it has a similar air about it.
So what was the final demise of this bridge? It lasted for a long time.
Well, basically the bridge was hell for stout. It was built of materials that never went bad. Most bridges that you see from those days are covered. Mm-hmm. And they have these long shed roofs on them. And the only reason that was there was to keep the bridge from rotting.
Yeah.
But I guess during his pole boat days, Henry Schultz saw all these cypress trees growing along the river. And he's just like, you know, I don't know if any of y'all ever saw the bridge of the River Kwai when the Colonel Alec Guinness and a couple of his officers are standing by the river and thinking about building this bridge for the Japanese. And this guy says, you know, there's a timber bridge in London that's last 600 years. And Alec Guinness's eyes just light up and he says, 600 years. And I'm sure Schultz had the same idea. He thought that bridge would be there 600 years later with a big brass plaque on it saying he was the man that built it.
And it might have been, except the flood wiped it out, right?
And floods, he had a good role. There didn't happen to be any really bad floods for probably about 30 years after the bridge was built. But then, you know, now a third of it was swept away, and now a quarter of it was swept away, and finally, in 1888, you know, their
whole thing.
They're, you know, the newspaper was talking about the crowd standing on the bank watching the trees slam into it and the houses slamming into it, and the gin mills slamming into it, and finally, it just gave up the ghost.
And it took quite a beating, though, apparently, before it went. So, one of the things I read on your website is you go around and you actually do. You actually sort of tell the story of Henry Schultz to people, and you actually do an impression of him. Is that correct?
Yes, I do. I started out very hesitantly because there really were a lot of people out there that knew a lot about Schultz, mm-hmm. and so I couldn't just, for example, walk into Edgefield, South Carolina, where history strikes very deep, and act like, you know, I was Schultz and I had all the answers and could field any question. I just didn't feel like I was up to that. But you know, then as I got on top of it a little more, I felt like, well, hell, I'll just be Henry Schultz the whole time. And so now I walk in and it's actually a little difficult because people want to ask questions about, well, what happened after Schultz died? And I have a little trouble with those because I'm dead. I don't know the answer anymore. They'll ask me questions like, well, which way are you facing in your grave? And are you facing Augusta or do you have your back to Augusta? I'll say, how am I supposed to know? I'm standing here talking to you. This is complicated enough. Don't make it any worse.
That was one of the things. I actually was curious about whether you were going to show up and be in character for the interview or not, because I saw on the newspaper clip on the website, it appeared that you did the whole interview in character. Or at least it looked that way.
And actually, it's gotten so the funnest part of that is the questions and answers afterward. I do give a speech with extra megalomania thrown in. And I guess people like that okay, but then when they start asking questions, that's when I can really start throwing out the sauce. You know, if somebody asks a dumb question, I'll just tell them, you know, that's, you know, well, you know, why do you ask me things like that? That's just silly. And, you know, things that a very eccentric, full of himself a Dutchman would have said. And, of course, I throw on a kind of a hokey Katzenjammer Kids accent to cap it all off. And they seem to like it just fine. That is, some people have actually seen it and come back a second time.
Now, is there any truth to that rumor that he's buried with his back facing Augusta?
I do not know.
Okay.
Nobody has ever seen his grave. It was unmarked from the get-go.
He apparently carried all that bitterness with him, though.
Yeah. Did he have a family?
Yes, he did. It was not out in the open, and the reason is that it was evidently a mixed-race marriage, which, if you know anything about South Carolina history, that was absolutely unheard of.
Yeah.
But he didn't care, and he pulled it off, and he just went ahead and did what he wanted, but it's not something that was in the newspapers.
Yeah.
And he didn't write articles about it at any rate. I haven't come across a single mention of it in a written source.
But so are his descendants around here, or do we even know?
We don't really know. There was a census that said, yes, there is Schultz, there is a woman of appropriate age, and there's several younger people in the household, but where they went or what happened to them, nobody knows. There's a Mariah Schultz out there someplace that quite likely is a daughter, but it's just unknown.
So wasn't there also a massacre over in Hamburg?
Well, some people like to call it a massacre, and others will punch you out unless you agree that the right way to term it is riot. But there's a lot of turmoil in South Carolina after the Civil War, and everybody pretty much got a raw deal out of it. I'm going to have to speak in racial terms, I'm afraid, because that's exactly what it was a race-inspired incident. But the white guys felt like they were getting a raw deal because they were being taxed off their land, and the government just wasn't being run correctly. And, of course, the freedmen had gotten a horrible deal because they were kicked off of the land and given absolutely nothing in its place with which to make a living for their families. So everybody was pretty much mad at each other. Now, as a result of politics driven from Washington, South Carolina came to be governed by the more populous group, which were the African Americans, or the freedmen. And the whites didn't like that at all, and finally in 1876, they said, this is going to be the year. Mississippi had just broken their radical Republican government by means fair and foul, and South Carolinians said, we can do the same thing, we're going to do it. And their only question was, how do we announce that this is happening and this is the way we're going to do it? And that happened in Hamburg. And you could say that the Hamburg Massacre was the Fort Sumter of the 1876 redemption of South Carolina, where the radical Republican government was defeated and consigned to the trash bin of history, and the whites resumed their role as the masters of both the state government and many of the people in it.
By the Jim Crow laws and all of that in that area.
I'm afraid so, and I think the Jim Crow laws stayed in pretty much in effect for the next 90 to 100 years.
Yeah.
And I don't think South Carolina gained by it either, unfortunately.
So is this the legacy that Hamburg unfortunately has in history books, or is it mentioned at all?
I think you'll find it mentioned. To tell you the truth, it's you have to be kind of interested in the subject to come across it. But there was a very trivial incident involving some black soldiers in Hamburg that were drilling in the street with their arms. They were part of the South Carolina National Guard. So they were actually, you know, uniformed troops with weapons and organizations supplied by the state. And they ran into some guys that were driving a carriage down the road. And there's two sides of the story. It splits off 50-50. One side says that the militia intentionally deployed across the road to block passage. And the other side says that the carriage intentionally drove themselves into the head of the marching column. Probably the truth lies somewhere in the middle. But somehow this became inflated into an incident where a formal Confederate general by the name of N.C. Butler came into Hamburg, demanded that the militia immediately give up their arms because of their irresponsible behavior. They refused. They holed up in their armory, as they called it, which was a brick building right across the river from Augusta.
They had no legal standing to do that, did they, to ask them to give up the arms?
No, the general did not. Yeah. He asked strictly on his own responsibility. He just said, we were tired of you guys being here. We don't want you doing this anymore. And he didn't want anybody else to be responsible. He wanted himself to be responsible as kind of showing, I think, the rest of South Carolina that now is the time for you to take charge of these, take charge of this unsuitable state of affairs and do what has to be done to fix it, as I did. So there was a gun battle. Hundreds of men assembled and blasted away at these guys holed up in the brick building. Finally, the black guys didn't surrender, but they kind of bailed out the back door and tried to disappear, but 20 of them were captured. And in what they called a dead ring, it's your classic gang of guys on the outside with the flaming torches, I'm sure, just like you'd see in a Frankenstein movie. And the guys huddled in the middle, they picked out four of them and executed them as troublemakers.
And your site is really the only place that I've seen any extensive recounting of that story. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot about it when we were doing searches last night on the internet.
Well, it's another one of those stories that, as they say, the victors write the history. And I'm afraid I'm if some people have pointed out to me, I'm not from around here. And I don't have any, you know, family to defend. I'm not, you know, I didn't have people that, you know, may have participated.
No vested interest.
And, you know, yeah. No vested interest at all. So I just want to try to figure out what happened and say it as plainly as I can without ticking anybody off, because once you make people mad at you, you can't communicate anything.
They're not going to talk to you. Yeah.
But so in my mind, one side of the story has been told for the last, you know, 130 years, and it's kind of time for the other side to at least get a chance. And after all, they had their gripes too. They had it tough. They were trying to raise their families and make a better life for themselves, you know, and they just were doing what they thought was best. But the safest position or the safest line that I've been able to take is that on that night, it was not just one guy that died. You know, there's one white man that was shot, but there were seven people that were killed. So, and I even like to list their names. There was Jim Cook was the town marshal, Moses Parks, there was Alan Attaway, Albert Meinhardt, David Phillips, and one more man whose name doesn't come to me right at the moment, and Mackie Merriweather. And there were seven men died that night for what they thought was right. And that was the Hamburg Massacre, which galvanized the Democrats into doing whatever they had to do statewide, fair or foul, to make the election good for them that November. And they hung on by their fingertips as it was, but pulled it off.
We were talking when the recorder was off. Did you say you were trying to draw attention to this event in, like, as something you're looking into now?
Not particularly. In fact, I was... To me, it's too hot to handle.
Yeah.
But there's actually another book that has come out called The Bloody Shirt by Stephen Budiansky. And I have to thank Mr. Budiansky because he's done some of the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
And he found some wonderful sources that tell the story with, you know, as told by original participants at hearings held in Colombia. There are actually people that survived being in the center of that dead ring that testified at this Senate investigation. It's mind-boggling, the stories that are told in there. So he had sources that actually objectively told what happened from both sides, and he wrote a gym-crack story out of that.
Wow.
I mean, to me, it comes a little strong from the other direction, but that's just fine because the red shirts have had it their way for 130 years, so let somebody get in a word.
Yeah.
I have no problem with that.
Well, at least you get some of that testimony in there so you can decide for yourself, even if, you know, maybe you take one tact or another.
Exactly. Exactly.
Because a lot of that information I hadn't seen anywhere else.
So tell us about some of Schultz's more colorful encounters.
Well, of course, there's the old story that he whipped a slave boy to death, and of course, that's completely wrong. He told somebody to whip a white guy to death. So, forget all that you've heard about that. I've told you the straight story. But what actually happened is there was a crime. A fella stole something off of a wagon. And Schultz was determined to get to the bottom of it. You know, as mayor of this up-and-coming town that he wanted to be renowned across the nation for being a great place to live and work. And he's convinced he knew this one guy had done it. So they pretty much subjected him to the enhanced interrogation and techniques that we've heard a little bit about today, up to and including Dick Cheney's waterboarding. And the story that was told was by the time some bypassers came on the interrogators, one fellow was standing by with the whip, which was a very heavy grapevine that he had literally covered the guy's body with red welts. And Schultz was ducking the guy's head in a ditch, in the water in a ditch.
Quite a fellow that Schultz was.
You know, trying to force him to confess to this crime. And anyway, this guy said, "Hey, are you sure you guys know what you're doing here?" And evidently they recovered themselves, and they may have been in a little bit of a passion, and it turns out the guy really was in bad shape. And he died a week later, probably from the dunking, I would say. He pulled a lot of that ditch water into his lungs and just couldn't handle it. So that other story that you heard is completely wrong. Oh, he had a terrible temper. So he went to Edgefield Jail and sat there for a while until he had his trial, which was a sensational event of almost nationwide importance. Congressman George McDuffie came down to participate in his defense, and he got off on a charge of manslaughter, which is where the old story that he was branded on the ball on the brawn of the thumb with the letter M, which stems from an old thing called Benefit of Clergy, an old legal fiction by which you got like one get out of jail free card for a felony. And back then the law is pretty simple. You committed a felony, we kill you. Except if you complete Benefit of Clergy, then you get off just this one time, and then we brand you to show that you have taken your get out of jail free card and can't do it again.
Sort of like our first offender status now.
Exactly.
If you're 17 and you do something terrible, you get your get out of jail free card. Yeah, except there's no branding. Yeah.
But in his case, it turns out that South Carolina felt like he was a valuable guy to have around. He helped their economy by stealing cotton from Augusta. And so he got a pardon from the governor. And although I've never seen it written, it's in my opinion that he was never branded.
Did I read this wrong, or was the sentence for manslaughter at the time 6 months in prison? I've read that somewhere.
It It pretty much was. I think if you do a search on brand with the letter M and manslaughter and things like that, you'll find other cases in the American South where that's exactly what they did. And it was all tied up in this benefit of clergy thing, which, you know, was dated back to England in like the 10th century. And it's actually even mentioned in the South Carolina's Confederate Constitution, that term. So South Carolina doesn't like to change, and if they have a 1,000-year-old English institution that nobody understands but is useful, they'll continue to hang on.
They'll run with it. Apparently, Schultz attempted to commit suicide at one point, didn't he?
Yes, he did indeed. Like I may have said before, he was a victim of his emotions. And he was not your dispassionate businessman. He was driven a lot by pride and desire for revenge, things like that. And he had a tremendous amount of himself wrapped up in that bridge. And as I mentioned, he was ripped out of the one toll booth at the Georgia end. And finally, he was ripped out of the toll booth at the other end. I don't know how it happened, but they said after repeated attempts, we were able to dislodge him from the South Carolina toll booth. And the next morning is when he actually committed suicide. So it's obviously the final loss. Well, he attempted suicide. He fired a pistol loaded with buckshot into his face.
Oh, man.
Well, like the photo on your website, when you're in character, I see there's like some red marks on your head. Is that to attempt that?
Yes. Yeah. I have a letter that was, a gossipy letter that was written to some vacationing South Carolinians in Newport, Rhode Island, that talks about the pistol of buckshot, and it hit him in the forehead, and it looked like he was in a doctor's hands, but it looked like he would survive. And then there's a later personal description of him that refers to the brand of cane on his forehead. And then there's the lost book in Texas that I've heard several people refer to that seems to mention that he actually wore a veil to disguise some disfigurement. That I don't know exactly what that was, but could be a powder burn, something like that.
When and how did he eventually die?
He just died of pure cussed old age in Hamburg. You know, as he went from one financial crisis to another, he ended up with increasingly smaller pieces of his town to sell and trade for a couple more years of life. And finally, he, as must happen, he ended up in complete poverty, pretty much living at the hands of a fellow German who agreed to go ahead and, who admired him and lived in Hamburg for decades afterwards. It's your typical poverty, intestate, left no will, left no epitaph. He was buried in a unmarked grave. It's just a sad story. It seems like he felt pretty much rejected at that point and didn't feel like anybody had valued his contribution.
Something we had talked about off the quarter, how did Hamburg eventually fall? How did it eventually fail?
Well, its business model was built on the Savannah River. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that farmers would grow their cotton and put it on a wagon and carry it to the nearest place where they could get rid of it. Because the hardest way in the world to tote product around, especially big heavy stuff like cotton, is in a wagon. And so Hamburg turned out to be the closest point for a lot of these guys in South Carolina. And at one time, 15% of the cotton crop in South Carolina came to Hamburg in wagons, backed up for miles on the road trying to jam their way into town. Finally, they'd bring in their three bales or whatever they'd managed to raise that year, sell it off at the warehouse. The warehouse guy would throw it on a steamboat and send it off to Charleston or Savannah. And from there it goes to spinning mills in England and northeastern United States. So that was the business model, and that started to get a little shaky when the railroads took hold. There were railroads built in the 1830s, but it wasn't really until about 1850 that they caught fire. And at that time, the whole idea of carrying your cotton in wagons, in a wagon for 3 weeks at a time, just didn't make sense anymore. You may as well just deliver it to the closest railway depot, get rid of it there, maybe 10 miles from your farm, and be done with it. And so Hamburg's reason to exist wasn't there anymore. Which is interesting, though, because there must have been something else. Augusta kept right on going. So it seems like there was still a financial apparatus in Augusta with the banks that the farmers still needed. And if anybody that knows anything about farming knows that you can't farm without getting a loan. It's just not possible. So maybe the financial structure in Augusta allowed them to get through that, and farmers still needed to come here to beg for money or buy the latest things to carry back home. I don't know what. They had to have something in the area. So Augusta soldiered right on until probably the early 1900s.
Yeah. And whereas Hamburg kind of had a major decline in the 1850s, but then after the Civil War had sort of a brief resurgence before its final and ultimate decline.
Yeah, Hamburg was a lot like one of two malls that were built in Augusta. It's called Regency Mall, and it had its heyday starting in the early 80s, but then for some reason people just didn't want to go there anymore. And now it's abandoned and it sits on top of a hill. Hardly anybody has set foot in the place for 10 years. It's just an absolute wreck. But I just have an idea that someday there'll be some squatter that will sneak in there and will start doing something useful with it. Next thing you know, the place will be going again, and folks will say, well, they shouldn't be there, but at least something's happening with it.
But look, they're painting the walls, they're scrubbing all the signs, they're better.
They're buying power from Georgia Power, and they have people coming in, they're serving a purpose, so you know, let's just look the other way. And I think the same thing happened in Hamburg when the freedmen who'd been found their life on the farms unacceptable found that they could live in Hamburg and work in Augusta. And they started a whole town over there with their own mayor and government, and they had cranked right back up to a population of 1,500 people, almost as many as in the glory days of cotton.
Before it was 1929 that a flood finally wiped it out for good?
Well, of course, after the massacre, things steadily dwindled, and I guess you could say Hamburg became an industrial slum. You know, the railroads loved to build their switching yards over there and so on. And you probably had a shadow population still hanging on in the old buildings over there. But finally, when it was just completely, disastrously flooded repeatedly in 1929, the American Red Cross stepped in and said, you know, look, you guys can't do this anymore. Let's just get out of here.
Yeah.
And that was the final end.
Is there any remnant at all of it left anywhere?
Not really.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting because the thing that they call Schultz Hill now is not the original Schultz Hill. You have Highway 1 that crosses the river. That's actually the same as the road that was there. You know, the Jefferson Davis Bridge, the old two-lane bridge, is exactly where Schultz's bridge used to be. That's a sixth bridge that has been in that identical location. And as you travel down that highway, to the left was the original Schultz Hill, where Henry had his park. He fired his cannons up there. He had his massive barbecues and receptions for the Marquis de Lafayette, you know, what have you. And then around 1920, when Carpentersville was built, somehow that area on the eastern side of the highway came to be called Schultz's Hill. I don't know why, but they're two different things.
What future plans have you got for telling Schultz's story?
Well, I'm kind of in a holding pattern right now because you know how you know, this is pretty time consuming figuring out all this stuff out. And, you know, we got hit up with some family business, so, you know, first things first. And I work out at Fort Gordon drawing pictures for the Army, and believe it or not, we've got a war going on, and we've got to train those soldiers and put out some people that, you know how to keep themselves alive over there. So that's pretty much tied me up in the last few years.
Yeah, sounds that way. All right, we really appreciate you coming out and talking to us today, and I learned a little bit. Did you learn a little bit?
I did. And how can people find your website if they want to read more about Henry Schultz?
All you really need to do is go to Google and type in Hamburg SC or
it'll
Henry
right
Schultz, S-H-U-L-T-Z,
right,
and it'll be right at the top.
All right. Well, all right. Thanks so much.
The song you heard in this podcast was Flux by Drop Trio, available only on Magnatune.com.
Thanks for listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network. Visit us at gapodcastnetwork.com. If you have a question, comment, or drunken rant, leave us a voicemail by calling 678-389-9441. Who knows, it might be featured in a podcast. You can also email us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com.